This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The way the basketball can bounce, it's fair to say a 12 will trounce a 5, and maybe that an 8 will one night be completely great and quite upset a 2 or 3. It's what we're likely now to see if we tune in the biggest dance. Did I say if? Hey, there's no chance we don't tune in. That's what you get when you have been compelled to bet upon the way the brackets break. Compelled, it's true. For mercy's sake, by pressure from the guy at work, whom you might write off as a jerk because he bugs you for your choices, but for all the other voices of your colleagues, smart and silly, who have filled out willy-nilly brackets, though they do not know how any of those games will go. Legend has it that one year a married couple, lacking fear, picked the way the games turned out, every one without a doubt. They no longer sit with all the wage slaves thanks to basketball. They wake at noon, I've heard that's true, admire the astounding view of ocean, distant yachts and such, and winter's icy, snowy touch. They needn't fear it, for they're set as rich as anyone can get and living on a tropic isle. And as they pass, the people smile and say they got the brackets right. They are a most inspiring sight. How did they do it, you may wonder, as your choices slip and blunder, fall to lesser teams and stumble, making you feel very humble? Did they choose their favorite shade of red or blue? Were choices made because they liked a player's beard? That might seem strange, but not as weird as going with which mascot might win out were there a mascot fight. I do not know, and nor do you, how they prevailed, if it is true they did, for it may be a story built to fill your dreams with glory. Will you be the next to hack it, filling out the perfect bracket? For millions of college basketball fans, this week marks the beginning of March Madness. But for the 30,000 registered runners in the Boston Marathon, it signals 4 weeks to go before race day. Keith Giroux, bib number 7467, hopes running the marathon will mean more than the chance to set a personal best. WBUR Shira Springer, bib number 7504, has our story.
Up here, where?
It's just before that tan building there.
We're driving through the foothills of the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, passing rundown houses and the abandoned Strathmore paper mill. We're headed to Turner's Falls for a run. This is the place where Keith Giroux grew up and got into trouble. Now, it's where he's trying to stay out of trouble.
The contrast between how I live today and how I lived 10 years ago is just so drastic. I started, drinking and smoking cigarettes, before I was 11. I became quite the alcoholic and got into heavier drugs.
By 17, Giroux was a dad. By 18, he was on his own. Sometimes he went to work high or with a hangover. Sometimes he didn't bother showing up at all. He lost his factory job, he couldn't pay the rent for his room in a boarding house, and he started breaking into bars and liquor stores for cash and alcohol.
I didn't start getting incarcerated until I was 18. And since then, I've accumulated 8 years of incarceration. Every bit of trouble I've ever got into was due to alcohol. Everything I've ever been incarcerated for was addiction-related.
His crimes range from breaking and entering to larceny to assault and battery. He's now 30. Back in August 2015, when he was locked up at the West Tennessee State Penitentiary, he started to change his life.
Running actually was born out of boredom. I was sitting in prison. I needed something different. There's a lot of card playing and TV watching, and everybody works out. But we didn't have much access to the gym, and I push-ups, pull-ups, dips, and all that just was not my thing. So I needed something new, and I decided to try running. I'd never been a runner before that. I, smoked cigarettes all my life and used to hate having to run in gym class. But getting out in that prison yard, every time we'd get out there, I'd try to run a little further and maybe a little faster, and it felt pretty good.
Giroux followed a grass path along the prison yard's perimeter, running beside an electrified razor wire fence. One lap around was about half a mile.
What did you think about when you were running around the prison yard?
Probably everything I wanted to do when I got out. Just all the dreams I've had, through all the years I've spent incarcerated, all I wanted to do with my life that I hadn't been able to yet. really just building a life.
Sometimes his thoughts drifted toward family. He hadn't been a part of his son's life for years, but he dreamed of building a relationship. 6 weeks after he began running, Giroux was transferred to the Franklin County Jail in Greenfield, Massachusetts. But in Greenfield, there was no yard, just a treadmill.
I started jumping on that every day, and before you know it, kind of became an obsession.
He set small goals, always trying to run farther and faster. He talked to the jail staff about training and racing, and soon he set one big goal. He would run a marathon in prison. Since he'd heard about the history and prestige of the Boston Marathon, he would make his attempt on the same day as the big race. The monotony of running 26.2 miles on a treadmill is mind-boggling. But for Giroux, that was just the start.
The shoes I had been running in were absolutely horrible. Plain white Velcro strap orthopedic shoes that were probably a bit small for me, too. I knew I couldn't run that far in those, so I was running around frantically looking for shoes, but we're very limited in there because you can only have shoes that are approved through their medical department and don't have shoelaces, and they're not built for running, you know. So at the last second before we locked in for the night, a fellow inmate lent me his shoes, you know, which were just some old classic Reeboks. They were crap. They were crap. They were beat up, no support, and you know, nothing. Not made for running either.
Another issue? Prisoners have to be in their cells at certain times. So he needed at least a 4-hour window without any scheduled headcounts. That meant he'd have to start his marathon when everyone else was at breakfast. And the prison treadmill was set to shut off after an hour. So Giroux planned to break his marathon into 6 segments. He would run a segment, then record his distance and time, then restart the treadmill, then do it all over again. At 7:30 a.m. on Monday, April 18th, 2016.
I'm in green cotton polyester jail-issued pants and a plain white cotton t-shirt and my crappy shoes. I have a portable Walkman radio. It's just a cheap little FM AM radio. I have a towel to wipe the sweat off and all that good stuff. I have a small cup of salt, handful of Jolly Ranchers, and a piece of paper and a pen to mark my times down on. A few minutes into that second segment, somebody brought me a water bottle, which was something huge because we weren't allowed to have those. We didn't have them ourselves, so they had to get approved through security and everything, and someone had to bring it to me. And then so that was cool. And then we had called up to the kitchen and had some ice sent down, so I was able to, you know, have some ice water and a nice little fancy water bottle as I ran.
Giroux felt good as he passed the halfway mark. It was the farthest he'd ever run. But
by the time I got to about 22 miles, I was tuckered out.
He slowed to a fast walk for a couple minutes, then refocused and sped up. He wanted to run across the finish line.
As the last mile approached, everybody started gathering around, and I had quite the little crowd. Inmates and staff. And that last half mile, I, you know, felt a little burst of energy coming out. It's like last quarter mile, I cranked it up to 10 and sprinted to the end.
Giroux's prison version of the Boston Marathon took 4 hours and 14 minutes. He'd hoped to run faster, but his disappointment faded as he set a new goal. He wanted to run a real marathon when he got out. Giroux says he's been released from jail more times than he can count. But when he got out last fall, it was different.
Every other time I walked out of incarceration, I walked out to not having any idea of what I was going to do with my life. You know, I still had dreams then, but I had no idea of how to set one foot in front of the other to work toward any of those. But this time, you know, I come out with this big goal of running a marathon, and all I have to do is run toward it.
Giroux ran his first real marathon 3 weeks after he was released, and he's still running. He gets training advice from running groups on Facebook. What shoes to buy, what workouts to try, what to eat.
Everybody who runs is always, like, posting their workouts, and I post a lot of my workouts to people who are just always very, very, very supportive, especially if you're, like, going hard on yourself, like, like, man, I had a crap workout. And I'd be like, no, you had a great workout. You know, it's, and they always tell you how proud they are of, like, all your accomplishing and everything. And it's a lot of motivation to keep doing good things. I've never accomplished anything before. So I've been out of jail now for about 4 months. Just the fact that I haven't found something to get myself back in is an accomplishment in itself. I've also been clean for 4 months that I've been out, which is another huge accomplishment. Every day is a struggle, but it's what allows me to live a life.
Through his new running connections, Giroux secured a charity entry into next month's Boston Marathon. He's been working 12-hour shifts at a new factory job and training mostly on dark, cold winter nights. 1 year after he ran Boston on a prison treadmill, Giroux will be cheered along the famous course by family and friends. But he knows one very important person will be missing from the crowd, his 13-year-old son.
Yeah, I've spent so much time away that he probably doesn't even remember me at all. And sometimes I worry about the things he might have heard about me, you know, growing up. And so I imagine what kind of picture he might hold in his head of what kind of man his dad is. And whatever it is, I want to change all that. I want him to see, you know, nothing but a good man.
And Keith Giroux hopes soon his son will see a good man who's finished the Boston Marathon. For Only a Game, I'm Shira Springer.
Derrick Jones Jr. always wanted to be an NBA player. But when the 2016 NBA draft rolled around...
We thought I was going to get drafted. Yeah, as soon as they got up to like 15 to 20, I just stepped outside and I couldn't watch it anymore.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. A listener named Sajaya has this to say about Only a Game. My father loved sports, any sport, and when I listen to this show every week, I feel closer to him. Plus, the stories and interviews are so interesting, even for someone like me who doesn't follow much sports. Thank you, Sajaya, for that heartfelt review. Consider leaving a review of your own on iTunes. It really does help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Boycotts, baseball, and Taylor Swift. That's what we've got coming up right now on Three Stories You Should Know. I wonder if this is the week I get to be Charlie Pierce and shout sports. Anyway, my guests this time around are Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports and Claire McNear of The Ringer. Greetings and salutations to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hello.
All right, I'm going to go first this week. The Women's Hockey World Championships are scheduled to begin in Michigan just 2 weeks from now. The defending champions may very well not be there. On Wednesday, the U.S. women's team announced that they would boycott the tournament because their attempt to negotiate a reasonable agreement with USA Hockey has gone nowhere for a long time. Women's hockey has been undervalued by USA Hockey for as long as I can remember. The stipends for the women are ridiculously low. There's been no attempt or virtually no attempt to market their success, even though they have won world championships and Olympic medals and everything else there is to win. 20 years ago, the U.S. women's soccer team publicized a struggle not unlike this one by boycotting a tournament, but it was not a world championship. It wasn't the Olympics. Maybe that's why nobody remembers it. Short of boycotting the Olympics, this really is a dramatic move, and I say good on these women. Some things, equal treatment, equal opportunity, for example, are more important than any hockey tournament, and I'm going to assume neither of you believe women shouldn't get equal pay, but how do you see this issue playing out across sports?
I got to say that it's not even about the money. It's obviously equal pay is a very important concept, but it's not like the men's team is driving a profit for USA Hockey or in soccer or anything else. There's no economic argument for treating them the way they've been treated. And if you look beyond just the money that they're paid. They weren't involved in a lot of public announcements during the Sochi Olympics. They are routinely left off of lists of champions and things. And while America's fascination with international hockey pretty much begins and ends with 1980, they have been far more successful, the women have, than the men. And it's been beyond insulting, and I'm glad they're boycotting. I think it's wonderful.
Claire, do you like the idea of a boycott, or do they hurt the game by doing this? And I'm really playing devil's advocate when I say that.
No, I don't think so at all. I think it's, you know, they're using the leverage that they have, and it's the reason why we're talking about it right now. But what's absurd to me is if you look at what they've been saying, you know, they're not even getting paid for what they're doing right now. They say that they get paid for the 6 months leading up to the Olympics, and that's it. That's the only time that USA Hockey
and it's $1,000 a month.
Right, yeah. Right. So, you know, an eighth of the time they get paid, and the boycott just kind of takes on another color when you think about it that way. It's absolutely absurd.
I still hope they play in the tournament. I want USA Hockey to cave, concede that all their demands are completely just, and then, by golly, let them go win the world championship. That's what I'd like to see. Craig, you're up next.
Well, let's keep it international, and here's an international competition that maybe people care about more, but maybe not, and we certainly have less success in it in the United States, and that's the World Baseball Classic, which is currently raging on in various locations around North America, Central America, South America, and parts unknown. This week, Adrian Gonzalez, one of the bigger stars to play in the World Baseball Classic, the Dodgers first baseman and the Mexican team first baseman, just ripped the WBC, the concept and the execution, saying that the WBC is trying to be the World Cup, but it's worse than Little League. It's, you know, Adrian Gonzalez is angry this week because Team Mexico was probably shafted a little bit based on some dumb rules in their round robin tournament in which they were eliminated. But he does raise a question about the WBC, its legitimacy, and whether people even care. It's popular, generally speaking. It gets decent ratings in other countries this year. Its TV ratings are a little bit better, even though most games are played in the wee hours of the morning or late at night. And the United States has never won this thing, so American baseball fans have had a very mixed reaction to the WBC in general. The question that happens every 4 years then is, what's the point? Is it worth doing? And it's one of those rare things in sports where I think you have to say it doesn't matter, but it's still worth doing. We are so binary when it comes to sports, especially professional sports. If it's not glory and wonderfulness, it's not worth doing at all. The WBC doesn't change anything. It's more interesting than the spring training games going on. It's fun to watch a game in the moment. We're going to forget who won the thing by mid-April, but I think we still do it. And if anything, it's weird to see such passion from someone like Adrian Gonzalez in it. But it's probably good, even though it's a very flawed tournament.
Well, I get the sense that Major League Baseball kind of wants the World Baseball Classic to be sort of a sandbox for baseball, and that, which has some good things and some bad things. And the sort of rule thing that happened with Adrian Gonzalez that he's so angry about was the result of them changing the rules on tiebreakers this year. They're sort of experimenting with different iterations and maybe didn't land on the best one, but they're playing with things. And obviously that leads to some outcomes like this one. But also, I have not had the pleasure of attending them, but it seems like these games are just a ton of fun, and they're maybe more fun than your typical MLB fair. They've got the bat flips and the crazy mascots and rabid fans that you would almost never see at a major league park during the midst of the season. So I don't know. I think it's about trying to strike a balance between those two.
All right, Craig, you mentioned the word popular, and Claire, you mentioned the word fun, and I'm in favor of fun. And I also think that nobody pays attention to baseball in Israel or baseball in Italy at any other time except when this tournament is going on. So I'm all for it.
I'll just say that I went to a 2013 World Baseball Classic match between the United States and Mexico in Phoenix, Arizona. And because I am the guy that I am, I put on a Mexico hat, a Mexico shirt, and I rooted lustily against my native country and had a few beverages and sat with the Mexican fans. And it was the most fun I have ever had in a baseball stadium. And I've been to multiple World Series games. So viva fun.
All right. It's time for me to establish my pop culture creds now. So let's shake off those last two topics, Claire. And what sort of trouble do you have for us?
All right, I'm going to start you guys with a big what if, and that is, what if Taylor Swift decides who wins the World Series? I know, it's crazy.
Sports!
It's crazy. But there is a weird amount, a mysterious amount, I would say, of evidence to suggest that maybe her records have magical baseball powers. She grew up in Pennsylvania, but the Phillies offended her in 2008, and then they lost the World Series the next year. Then she moved on to the Giants, and in the fall of 2010, 2012, and 2014, she released an album. And weeks later, every time, the Giants won their first, second, and third albums. Sorry, excuse me. They won their first, second, and third World Series since moving to San Francisco in the 50s. But the Giants' even-year streak ended last year. And I think the signs now suggest that she's thrown her weight, such as it is, behind the Astros. Her only show scheduled for the entirety of this year was last month in Houston. Mm. Houston Astros is 13 letters long. She's shown an affinity for the number 13. There's an Astros cap hidden in the music video of Bad Blood. Ooh. So what I'm saying is, put all your money on Houston.
Her last album was called 1989. That was the year the Giants won the pennant, too. So I think that's probably worth thinking about a little bit.
I don't know that you're right about that.
I think I started off thinking about this as a joke, but maybe not joking anymore.
If we're going to talk about influential singers having something to say about who wins the World Series, I'd just like to point out that Bob Dylan is 75 years old. 7 minus 5 is 2. 2 years ago, Kansas City won the World Series. Bob spelled backwards is Bob. Whoa. And Dylan is Nellid. So the Cubs will repeat unless the University of Connecticut women's basketball team enters the American League, in which case they'll win the World Series.
I'm sold.
That's rock solid.
You've convinced me.
I have to tell you, I get a lot of people asking me about who they should place wagers on in baseball. This is the time of year people put a lot of prop bets on what team is going to win the pennant and all that sort of thing. And my response to them always is, you're a moron. Don't bet on baseball. It is completely unpredictable. The fates of any one game are beyond our comprehension. So, you know what? I am willing to believe that Taylor Swift controls baseball because that would be more logical than what actually seems to control it.
I can't wait to see the listener response to this theory. My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Claire McNear of The Ringer and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Thanks to both of you and, of course, to Taylor Swift as well. Have a good week.
Thanks again.
I'm going to let you finish, Bill.
Derek Jones Jr., 6'7", 197 pounds, had a plan to get to the NBA. 2 years ago, he was a high school senior and basketball star in Chester, Pennsylvania. At that point, the plan was to spend an extra year at a prep school before enrolling in college. He visited St. Francis Academy in Baltimore, and while he was there, he took advantage of the opportunity to take the ACT, an alternative to the SAT. An acceptable grade on either test would make Jones eligible for a D1 athletic scholarship.
I studied for months. And I felt as though I was ready to take the test. I went in, I took a deep breath, prayed to God before I took the test. It was a nail biter. I was like pulling my hair out, just waiting for them test results. And when my dad told me I got the test results back, I didn't want to look at it first. I wanted my parents to look at it. But my dad looked at the email and he seen that I got the right score that I needed. I mean, he just broke down. My mom broke down in tears. I was my parents' first child to go to college, and it was a blessing. I was thankful for that.
Jones scored a 27 on the test, higher than he needed. He figured he was home free, so he altered the plan, skipped prep school, and went straight to the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. As a freshman, he maintained a GPA of 3.25, and he averaged over 11 points a game. The dream of an NBA debut might have beckoned Jones then, but he felt he'd be better prepared for the pros when he'd put a couple of more years' worth of muscle on his lanky 6'7 frame, and besides, he was happy.
I loved UNLV. It's like my second home. I mean, I'm always going to be a running rebel.
Always a running rebel, maybe, but not as a sophomore. Suspicions had arisen regarding the scores of some of the athletes who'd taken the ACT with Jones at St. Francis Academy. Toward the end of his freshman basketball season, Jones was told that UNLV would have to enter the conference tournament without him.
They actually emailed me and they said that they was going to flag my score. I didn't understand it, and I took it to my coach, and that's when they told me I was ineligible and I wasn't able to play anymore. I mean, nobody really understood why they did it, because, I mean, I took the test. I got the score that I needed. I mean, I got higher than the score that I needed. So, I mean, I really didn't understand what the whole situation was for.
Jones would not be allowed to continue at UNLV or at any other D1 school. He made himself available for the NBA draft as a 19-year-old.
We thought I was going to get drafted. And my parents threw like a little party. Me and all my friends was there. All my family was there. I mean, all the people that was close to me was all there. And they, as soon as they got up to like 15 or 20, I just stepped outside and I couldn't watch it anymore.
Regarding Derrick Jones, there was nothing to watch. No NBA team drafted him. Like all hopefuls who come up empty on draft night, he became a free agent, free to sign with any team that was interested in seeing him play in summer camp. The Sacramento Kings took that chance, but an injury prevented Jones from playing at all. And then the Phoenix Suns looked beyond Jones' injury and beyond his scarlet U for undrafted, and they signed him to a preseason contract in September. Jones grabbed the opportunity with both hands and held on hard, hoping to make the opening night roster.
It was the day of cuts, and they called me in the office, and they asked me if I knew what I was in there for. And I told them I didn't. I knew it was the day that they had to make cuts, but, I mean, I didn't know what was going to happen.
What happened was that the Suns signed Jones to an NBA contract. Mission accomplished, right? Huh? Not quite. A few days later, he was assigned to the Northern Arizona Suns, Phoenix's developmental or D-League affiliate, so he had to be disappointed, right? With all the things that had gone wrong with the plan Jones had made, this had to be one more nasty surprise, the sort of thing bound to turn a young man bitter and sulky, except...
I mean, I just went down there and I embraced it, and I'm going to be one of the hardest workers that the Phoenix Suns ever seen.
Derrick did have a great attitude about being in the D-League.
Ty Ellis is head coach of the Northern Arizona Suns.
And it's very uncommon, unfortunately. These young kids or young men, they assume the D-League is a demotion, and it's not. The D-League is a perfect opportunity for you to grow and also stake your claim that you belong in the NBA.
Jones says he's okay with playing in the D-League for as long as it takes to learn the basketball he didn't learn in college. And Coach Ellis agrees.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The only difference is at this level, it's all about basketball. You don't have to worry about school and grades and studying and things of that nature.
3-on-1. Off for Jones. Throws it down left-handed.
Fortunately for Derrick Jones, it's only 100 miles from the Prescott Valley Events Center, where the Northern Arizona Suns do business, to the Talking Stick Resort Arena in Phoenix, home of the NBA Suns, because Jones has shuttled back and forth between the two venues more than half a dozen times this season. As an on-again, off-again NBA player, he dunked well enough to be invited last month to the NBA Slam Dunk Contest during the All-Star break. He finished second. Coach Ellis was among the unsurprised.
Everybody is so excited about his athletic ability when he dunks, and rightfully so. But there was a game against Sioux Falls, and we was playing against Briante Weber. He's in the NBA now with Charlotte, and he's a point guard. And Briante was having a good game against us, and Derrick asked me if he could guard him. I said, yeah, you know, I want you to take that challenge. And he did a phenomenal job on him. And Derrick picked him up full court and just got us back into the game. And so that particular game, I'm like, this kid can be special.
Special might seem easy praise. Who among players good or nearly good enough to make the NBA isn't special? But consider the route Derrick Jones Jr. had to take to earn that distinction, particularly the detours. According to Ty Ellis, all that adversity has helped build a player more prepared for the NBA than he'd otherwise have been.
Derrick is maturing, and I give him so much credit, because when I was 19, I was a sophomore knucklehead in college, and this guy has so much pressure, and I think he is doing a phenomenal job of handling it.
When you're playing with and against the greatest basketball players in the world, except on the nights when you're playing with and against the guys who are trying to earn or regain the right to make that claim, maturing is a fine thing to be doing. But if you're Derrick Jones Jr., even as you mature, you don't want to lose the enthusiasm that has taken you so far.
I want to be the defensive player of the year as many times as I can. I'm going to be that defender, and hopefully I'm going to be able to contribute on the defensive end to win championships.
Seems as if the enthusiasm is still there, nor is confidence likely to be a problem. Attorney Jerry Dworkin set out to assemble the largest trading card collection of its kind.
Always joking that the cards would one day end up in the Hall of Fame, but never really believing it, probably in my heart of hearts.
Did the cards get the call from Cooperstown? That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can see Dworkin and his cards on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. We know you like podcasts because you're listening to one. But all this month, we want to ask you to go one step further. Share the love. Find someone who has never downloaded a podcast, or maybe somebody who doesn't even know they exist, and tell them about one that they'll enjoy. You'll be opening up an entirely new world to them. Whether it's this podcast or another, we'd love to know what you're recommending. Tell us with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a seventh-grade basketball player is expelled from school after her father sues to get her on the boys' team. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
I have before me former President Obama's brackets. I like to call them the Baraka brackets. For the men, he has North Carolina facing Duke for all the marbles. Kind of a boring pick, isn't it?
Well, also a kind of revolting one because it would give us an entire week of real sanctimony that would be almost impossible to endure. The previous president, of course, has also picked the women's tournament and has gone way out on a limb and picked the University of Connecticut.
Yeah. Now, there's a problem here, of course, because UConn only gets to play in their own neighborhood until the semifinals. Charlie, can this team win on the road?
I don't know. It's the adversity that the UConn women have overcome this year is incredible. Mm. I do want one of them, though, when they win the tournament, because they're not going to lose to anybody. I want one UConn player to say, nobody thought we could do this. Just to mock that cliche out of existence forever.
The Indiana University men's team failed to make the tournament for the second time in four seasons. So 9-year veteran head coach Tom Crean was fired on Thursday. Did he deserve that fate?
I don't know. I mean, he's a former Marquette coach who got Marquette to the Final Four with Dwayne Wade. He's a good coach. He's been a little bit out of his depth at Indiana because their fan base is insane. And then they had this incredible mess over the NIT bid where they didn't want to play, and then they didn't want to play at home because they didn't want the possibility that the legendary Assembly Hall would be half empty on television. So, I mean, if Indiana was looking for an excuse to make a clean sweep, they had one.
Lonzo Ball is playing for UCLA in the aforementioned tournament, Charlie. He is one of three basketball-playing sons of LeVar Ball, who revealed this week a marketing plan. If you're Nike, do you leap at the opportunity to sign all three of his sons for a cool $1 billion?
Nike does not operate the way the rest of humanity does. So, in fact,
it may happen.
In fact, occasionally Nike employs the rest of humanity. They can do that. That's the scary thing. I think LeVar Ball is headed towards becoming Earl Woods on steroids and heading towards ruining his son's happy career in the NBA. There's a lot of talk in Boston right now because the Celtics will draft very high, that Lonzo Ball will be the pick that comes to the Celtics. I don't think Brad Stevens wants anything to do with Pops, though.
The Arnold Palmer Invitational Golf Tournament is underway, and for the first time it lacks Arnold Palmer, who died in September. On the occasion of the tournament bearing his name, tributes to Mr. Palmer have been plentiful. Have you a favorite among them?
Well, not so much a tribute as a video that has Arnold Palmer's Augusta National yardage book that he kept, you know, through all his careers, which is really kind of interesting because they're hand-drawn drawings of the grade of the green and where the pin placement might be. And if you're a golf nerd, it's like finding the Holy Grail.
Treasure. When you were a kid and you went out for recess, I want to know if you were coached, and I'm asking this because some public schools have been increasing recess time following recommendations of the CDC and a group called Shape America to do that. And in some cases, the schools are providing a more structured experience by assigning coaches. Coached recess has to be an oxymoron.
First of all, America is the most overcoached nation in the world. Far, far too many coaches in America. You know what the coaches I had when I was going to recess were my fellow classmates who said things like, how could you possibly drop that pass?
And then at the end, someone would shout, get back in here.
That's right. And then a nun would come out the steps, and that was coaching, let me tell you.
Former Major League Baseball star Manny Ramirez will play with the Kochi Island Fighting Dogs in Japan this season. I don't know what his salary will be, but he's got some awesome perks. He'll wear his familiar 99 jersey, and it will simply say Manny on the back, and he'll get a chauffeured Mercedes limousine, unlimited sushi, and practice will be optional. It's pretty much the same deal he had with the Red Sox.
Well, yeah, the practice optional part was sort of unspoken and unwritten, but yeah. The unlimited sushi's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he was such a fan, but certainly he's in the right country for it. And can I just say that the Kochi Fighting Dogs is a great name.
It is. I want the jersey.
I do. I really do.
And finally, Charlie, in baseball, players congratulate each other with butt slaps and high fives. I guess it's a little bit different in the NHL, at least if you play for the Islanders and your teammate is John Tavares.
Yeah. Yeah. He scored a goal, and Jason Chimura, one of his teammates, came over and gave him a little chuck on the shoulder there, and Tavares turned back and socked him in the face. I don't know what this is about. There are some things about hockey that I just don't understand.
They'll never take fighting out of hockey because they fight even when your teammate scores a goal.
Even when they're happy, they fight.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce.
Of course, Bill, if Tavares had scored a hat trick, Chimura might be in the hospital right now.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
This is a story about obsession, not the kind that drives athletes to push harder and train longer than their opponents do, and nor is it the kind that leads fans to paint their faces or wait out in the cold for a chance to see the stars. No, this is a story about the obsession of a sports collector. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Jerry Dworkin is a corporate attorney living in Southern California, but it's his hobby that's made him comfortable sitting in radio studios talking to people like me, or maybe not.
No, this is the first radio interview. I did film a segment of ESPN's Mint Condition was the show. I stared in the wrong place for half the interview, but the rest of it went well.
Jerry Dworkin is a collector, and his collection is so vast and so strange. Well, I'll let him say it.
I think you could say, arguably, this is the most unusual collection of any Hall of Famer probably ever to be, given that the trading card company industry is not what it was way back when.
Way back when began in May of 1998. That's when the Dodgers traded future Hall of Famer Mike Piazza not to the Mets, where he would finish out his career, but
he has yet to have an official at-bat with the Marlins.
Yep, the then Florida Marlins, where he played pretty well.
And so Piazza with his second Marlin RBI, and it's a 1-0 lead.
8 days and five games after Piazza arrived in Florida, he was shipped north to New York. Jerry Dworkin wasn't aware of any of this when it happened. See, he's not actually a baseball fan, and in 1998, he didn't have any intention of collecting anything. But when one of Jerry's friends mentioned that a trading card had been issued to commemorate Piazza's 8 days, five games in Miami,
I was just struck by the oddity of the situation and that a card had been produced and that it would probably become valuable someday. So I did buy it.
Jerry couldn't describe that card for me. He doesn't remember exactly which card in his collection was first. That's because there were a lot more Piazza Marlins cards issued, and eventually Jerry would set out to collect them all. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Quite honestly, I thought at the time it would be the only card ever issued. But in fact, a number of additional cards were issued in the year of the trade, 1998.
Jerry acquired those cards too, and again, he figured that would be the end of it. It wasn't.
It was to my great surprise that in 2002, things started to show up again. Once I knew there were more being produced, I never stopped looking.
You might be wondering what the trading card industry was thinking, issuing all those cards commemorating Piazza's time with the Marlins, years after those 8 days, five games were up. Jerry never got a direct answer to that question. But what we do know is that the trading card industry was in a bit of a funk, and in order to drum up excitement, they were releasing all sorts of ultra-limited edition cards. Some were unique. They're called one-of-ones. Some had patches of uniforms or other memorabilia attached. The strategy backfired, flooding the market, reducing card values, and turning off collectors. But not Jerry. Jerry saw the opportunity to do something special.
Always joking that the cards would one day end up in the Hall of Fame, but never really believing it, probably in my heart of hearts.
Every morning, Jerry would check eBay. He always had at least a couple of searches running. He also placed a general alert on the Craigslist sites all around the country. And then there were the inquiries and comments he left on all of the sports forums and trading card sites. It was a little obsessive.
I don't necessarily put the label on it, but it certainly was a morning ritual. And believe it or not, my collection at least stands at 117 different cards of Mike Piazza as a Marlin or containing a piece of his Marlins uniform. They're all different cards. These are not duplicates.
Yep. Jerry owns 117 different cards commemorating those 8 days, five games, which is not exactly all of the cards that were produced.
If you go by the records, and the records are not necessarily complete, there were about 124 pure Piazza Marlins cards where he was clearly labeled as a Marlin.
14 of the cards in Jerry's collection are one of ones. Jerry chanced upon some of them. Others took a bit more work.
I actually located one card held by a gentleman in Taiwan. And it took some negotiation over a period of months. But I did finally get him to sell me that card.
Jerry doesn't remember exactly which card that one was either. For him, and he believes for most collectors, the thrill of the hunt is a big part of the appeal. He says he spent somewhere in the low five figures on his collection, and while he cherishes his cards, he really seems to have gotten the most joy from that daily ritual, checking his internet searches over a cup of coffee every morning and dreaming of one day making it into the Hall of Fame. So he doesn't spend too much time looking at his cards, except for one.
The one that I'm fondest of, for whatever reason, is a card that contains a button from Mike's Marlin uniform. That just struck me as unusual. Obviously, there were just so many jerseys worn and so many buttons on each jersey. And there were three cards produced containing a Marlins button, and I do have one of those cards.
Over the years, Jerry has struck up friendships with other collectors. He says that's a big part of what he's gotten out of this. But he's also made a friend of another sort, sort of. When Mike Piazza released his autobiography, he came to Southern California for a book signing.
I was the second or third person in line. And when I got up to Mike, I introduced myself as the Marlins guy. And it was clear that he recognized who I was through the glint in his eye. As I handed Mike the books, I said, "Mike, sign them, go Marlins." And the two gentlemen standing by the side of him said, "No, no, no, we've got to keep the line moving, autographs only." And when I returned to the car, it wasn't until then that I realized, against the advice of his handlers, he had in fact signed one of the books, Go Marlins, for me. And I kind of saw that as his personal wink and nod to my collecting efforts on his behalf.
In November of 2012, several months before Mike Piazza was eligible for election into the Hall of Fame, Jerry decided it was time for his collection to go public.
For so many years, I had been saying these cards were going to make it into the Hall of Fame, and there was no way that was going to happen unless I did something to make it happen.
So Jerry wrote to newspapers and magazines and told them about his collection. When Piazza didn't get elected right away, Jerry pumped up the publicity the next year and the year after that.
each of those times, I was writing to the librarian at the Baseball Hall of Fame, Jim Gates.
Jerry says Gates never gave him any reason to believe his collection would ever make it to the hall. But then one day in 2015, he got the call.
In the day and age of phones where you see who's calling, up on my screen popped the name Cooperstown. So you can imagine my heart skipped a beat at that moment. I had no idea what the purpose of the call was, but it was clear who was calling. And that was, in fact, Jim Gates.
The Hall of Fame was putting together a new exhibit that would aim to capture the complete baseball experience in modern times. They wanted to display 24 of Jerry Dworkin's Piazza Marlins cards. Jerry said yes. Had you ever been to the Hall of Fame before you were in the Hall of Fame?
No, and it was probably the highlight of my life. We were invited, my wife and I, as VIPs, a rare experience for us for sure, for the opening of the exhibit. And it was an absolute thrill to stand by this display of my cards. And I had just the best time of my life pointing to these cards and telling people, these cards are mine.
Last winter, after Mike Piazza was finally elected, but before he was inducted, he took a tour of the Hall of Fame. The tour guide told Jerry that both Piazza and his wife took cell phone pictures of his collection. Do you feel completed, or is there still more work to do with this collection?
In fact, I do feel completed. I have accumulated the largest collection in the world of its kind. It can't be duplicated or replicated, given I have too many of the one-of-ones to anybody have anything larger. So I really do feel like I've accomplished my mission.
Jerry has very recently finalized an arrangement with Golden Auctions to put his cards up for sale, except for one.
I will say I am retaining the button card. I'm not letting the button card go. I'll have that on my dining room or kitchen table to remind me of my glory days.
Jerry Dworkin isn't sure he'll find a buyer, but he says what he's most excited about is the fact that his collection will be displayed at the National Sports Collectors Convention at the end of July.
Well, assuming that it finds a new home and the right home, there will be no reason for you to go on eBay every morning and look for more cards. What will you do with your time?
That is a very good question. I will tell you that I was on eBay this morning looking for cards, even though I've reached this agreement with the Golden Organization. I suspect it's going to be a habit that's going to take a little breaking, but like all habits in time, I'm sure it can be broken.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and Mike Moschetto. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word this week comes from Jerry Dworkin, who explains why he always refers to Mike Piazza by only his first name.
Now that I've gotten the handshake and the wink and the nod and the Go Marlins book signing, I guess Mike and I must really be friends.
The handshake, not necessarily, but the wink and the nod, yeah, I guess you can go with that. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.